God, it's happening again, man!
Sunshine, lollipops, and rainbows. Everything that's wonderful is what I feel when we're together. Brighter than a lucky penny when you're near the rain goes, disappears, dear, and I feel so fine just to know that you are mine. My life is...
It was the European and North American civilizers, so-called, who went in there and destroyed the villages and destroyed their industries and destroyed their townships. That's what the history's about. That's what John Wayne is about. They reverse that history, stand it on its head. They do what Joseph Goebbels said. They give you a big lie, and they embellish it, and they make you root for the guys in the wagon train.
This is the end of the world.
Okay, so racism, sexism, speciesism, ableism. I know a lot of people like to pretend like these are unfortunate symptoms of an illogical system, but they are not. They are vital components of what is a very logical system where sanity is discouraged and dysfunction is the goal. Okay? And it's this very dysfunction which provides so handsomely for our material culture through the exploitation of poor brown women and fucked up death trap matchbook factories all over the globe. We've raised generations of people in a house that is falling apart, and it's soon going to be condemned. The wiring is ancient, the infrastructure is decaying, and the permitting process is a bureaucratic and existential nightmare. So, do we invest the time and personal expense to repair it out of a sense of love, or do we scrap the whole thing, cut our losses, and just try to build something better? Welcome back to Visions of Color, where we explore alternative revolutionary philosophies and take a look at the groups and the people that are making a positive impact in our communities. Shortly before the last election, I sat down with District 3 candidate Jessica Guerrero to talk about some of the issues that she was tackling with her campaign, as well as some of the issues with our fair city.
My name is Jessica Guerrero. I'm a candidate for City Council for District 3. I'm born and raised in San Antonio, born and raised in the southeast side, which is mostly District 3, and I'm running because I think the background that I have as a community organizer and grassroots and cultural organizing really puts me in a position, you know, where I respect, I admire, and, you know, really value the community's input. I think it's something that often, you know, is not valued at City Hall, and I want to make sure that it is. I want to be part of reclaiming City Hall for everyone in San Antonio. I've thought about it for the last few years. It's been suggested to me throughout, you know, just from friends and people throughout the community, but once I saw what happened at Mission Trails, I kind of walked with the residents. I wish that I would have been a much more prepared and really more effective support. But I was there to help with translations, interpretation, because most of the residents were Spanish monolingual speakers. The city didn't make available, you know, resources for them to really understand what was going on. Beyond the language barrier, there's just a process barrier in San Antonio, and people did not have access to, you know, the information they needed. When they looked for their city council person, she was nowhere to be found. So seeing, you know, all of those things kind of one after the other, kind of a domino effect of failed processes for the residents at Mission Trails. And then again, after that, seeing no remorse, no accountability, no lessons learned from our current city council representative, that really motivated me to just take a look and acknowledge that you know, maybe I'm in a position to affect how things are in my district sooner than later. I didn't feel quite ready as far as funding and other positioning, but I just felt a great need to try just to take that first step and really try to create some kind of change sooner than later, because we can't afford to wait in District 3. Again, there's no accountability for our representation in District 3, and that has to change. We have to make sure that we're at least bringing these difficult decisions, these difficult issues up, and, you know, really, you know, forcing our representative to take on those difficult decisions. I think District 3 is really in a position to lead the city in developing a fair housing policy. We do not have a housing policy currently, and District 3 was witness and, you know, central site to one of the largest residential displacements in recent history just 3 years ago. It was terrible enough that that happened at Mission Trails Mobile Home Community, but to add insult to injury around that issue, there seems to have been no lessons learned around what happened there. And we really need District 3 and the rest of San Antonio to understand the impact of the displacement that occurred there, to acknowledge the fact that it can and will continue to happen throughout San Antonio, especially as we continue to really prioritize the needs of incoming residents to the area rather than the needs and ongoing challenges of the current residents of San Antonio. I think it's really exciting. I think in general, right, the kind of re-energizing that's happened, you know, with people, you know, throughout different areas, different communities. I think that's really important. Within the women's movement, I think initially we saw a little bit of distance or lack of connection with inclusion with communities of color, with women of color. But I think that people, you know, reacted and took those difficult conversations on and were able to move to a better place pretty quickly, I think. I think what happened around, the Women's March was really an indicator of that. People, you know, women from various communities were able to come together and reclaim feminism in our own way, right? And really make it, claim it as something that we understand from the experiences we have as women of color, as queer women, as women in the South. I think it was a really important moment. I think it's been an important kind of point of kind of reawakening for a lot of people, a point of renewed hope. I've seen a lot of elder women really, really they just look different after that march because they're so excited that so many younger women are now, you know, taking a more active role in community organizing and in politics. I think it's important for us to come together in any way that we can to really acknowledge, you know, the commonalities that we do have, the common experiences that we have, and value any difference in perspective that we do have, and not demonize each other for those differences, but figure out, you know, how those can be bridges and connections between communities. I think it's important to be sure that we do maintain and continue to build a leadership of the most vulnerable people, of people of color, of women, indigenous women, queer women. I think that leadership is important, but I don't think that building that leadership excludes anyone. That's one of the things that I think people are starting to at least start to be a little bit more open to the possibility that the local does have a global impact, and that what happens in our neighborhoods, what happens in our local elections really does have, you know, a connecting impact on national politics. And I think we're also, a lot of people are starting to acknowledge the responsibility we have as residents of this country to take an interest, to take on more action, to take on more responsibility for ourselves. Again, you know, even within our neighborhood, because that has this broader reaching impact throughout the world. The world needs to see that we do not agree with what our government is doing in a lot of places throughout this country, and acknowledge that it impacts communities throughout the world. I think it's really important to make sure that quality education is absolutely accessible to our communities. And I don't think that's going to happen by privatizing the education system. I think we need to, as in, you know, a lot of places of budget and funding allocation, I think we should do a better evaluation of how money is currently spent. And definitely, I think it's a solid need that we need to increase funding for public schools. I think both are needed. There, you know, there needs to be an evaluation, improvement, and additional funding. Privatizing education is not going to make it more accessible to the people that need it. I feel that my background and my experience in grassroots organizing and cultural organizing really puts me, it's developed a unique skill set for me where I think I have a patience, an endurance, a willingness that often political candidates don't have for really seeking out real community input and not only seeking it out at certain points in a process or at certain times in an election term, but really working at maintaining that ongoing communication throughout a term. I think the job of city council representative is really hard. I don't think it's easy at all, but I think given the work that I've done and, you know, living in and with and being proud to be part of the community that I'm from and also having been, you know, on this side of City Hall, right? I think, you know, I've been with my neighbors, with my, you know, sisters in the struggle on this side of City Hall, asking for certain things, requesting, demanding, calling out, you know, and asking for accountability. I think I have a unique perspective that will really put me in check and will really hold me accountable to my constituents, to the residents that I represent. I think it also gives me, you know, it's given me unique skills to be able to collaborate and figure things out with other people. I think that's one of the things we're really lacking in San Antonio City Council is that there isn't enough collaboration between districts. I think there's some communication between district representatives, but not, I haven't seen real collaboration. I mean, even though, you know, so many decisions are unanimous, so many votes at City Hall are unanimous, I don't see that as an accurate indicator of inter-district collaboration. I think it's an indicator of compromise. I think it's an indicator of compromises and straight up deals that are made, you know, for personal benefit often. And I think it's really important that we really, you know, hold ourselves accountable to the communities we represent and understand that, you know, the line on a map that shows where our jurisdiction, you know, ends is not a line that is perceived when you live in that community. And people need to, you know, feel the same moving from one district to another and feel the same, you know, have the same access to education, to, you know, good streets, to proper drainage, to a life with dignity, you know, it's a good workplace, etc. I think that in order to do that, in order to really achieve that, we have to have more collaboration between districts.
How do you view Planned Parenthood's role in San Antonio, in our community?
I think they have made a really huge and it seems pretty far-reaching effort to educate people more on what services are provided, what Planned Parenthood is as a more holistic service to women and to the communities that their patients and clients, you know, belong to. I think it's an important education that's happened. They're an important presence in San Antonio. I've seen them, you know, connect to really grassroots efforts like the San Antonio International Women's Day March. That's just, you know, it's a loose coalition of individuals and organizations, and Planned Parenthood has connected to, you know, being present in the planning and supporting in ways that they can. I've seen them, you know, continue to do their luncheons and, you know, ticketed fundraising efforts that, you know, bring in a different community. And I think that's important. I think it's really critical to making sure that people really do understand the complexity of, you know, the issues that surround Planned Parenthood and also the importance of the services that they offer. I think the Martinez Street Women's Center is doing a lot for mothers and for young girls and teen girls. Southwest Workers Union is doing a lot of good work around and really enduring work around community gardening and finding alternatives for just greener, healthier living, and also building analysis of current local and global politics. TOP, Texas Organizing Project, I don't really know them throughout Texas, but the organizers that I've met here in San Antonio, I really respect their work and their approach and their willingness to kind of connect issues across the board. And yet, you know, stay really focused kind of in a certain community in San Antonio and move people through a political education that I think, you know, becomes more of a concientización, like building a consciousness, right, and understanding the connections between different issues. Unite Here is a local union focused on service workers, and they are one of the first organizations that I observed also really, you know, connecting issues beyond labor. A lot of times, you know, unions are very, very hyper-focused on labor issues and are not active on other issues, and I've seen Unite Here really kind of bust through that kind of structure. And I think that's really important. I think it's important for all of us to really understand how our issues connect. The San Antonio Women's Day March, it's, you know, again, a coalition of individuals and organizations, and we've approached women's issues as being community issues, right? There aren't just a set of women's issues that only pertain or that only affect women. Anything that affects women is going to affect all of our communities.
What about the recent immigration policies of the current administration and the rapid increase of activity by ICE?
I think that's something that we have to continue to look at, really closely, and be very, you know, willing to make, to take bold actions as a community and also at City Hall. I think that it's not accurate or fair to assume that, you know, any representatives at City Hall to assume that we don't have a position, you know, that we don't have a stake in that conversation. I think that it's also really important to learn from other communities that have gone through similar situations, like Arizona, where, you know, they've seen really dire circumstances similar to this, you know, years ago. And they can help us anticipate, you know, what might be coming in San Antonio and other areas, because as much as urgent, bold, deliberate action and analysis is needed, we need to be sure that we don't you know, panic and shut down opportunities that can, you know, detriment us in the future, right? I think we need to be sure that there is ongoing conversation, communication between various communities so that we continue to understand and acknowledge the parallels and experiences that we do have and the expertise that people have. People that are going through these things need to be at the front of helping any officials, police, City Hall, anyone in between, understand, you know, what's going on and how they're going to be impacted by the decisions made. If the people most impacted by what could happen are not at that decision-making table, we're just going to be spinning our wheels.
What do you think about the use of excessive force and the increased effort at holding law enforcement accountable?
I acknowledge that it's real, that it is happening, that it is a problem, as much as, you know, there are sometimes you know, press efforts to diminish, you know, how often those things do happen in our community in San Antonio. I think that it's important to continue, you know, for community to continue to pressure, SAPD and the city of San Antonio to confront those issues and try to figure them out. Again, they need to be sure that the most impacted people are at the table to try to figure that out. I think that the task force that was recently formed was more of a measure to placate community that was starting to become more active, more vocal around the issue. And I think, you know, again, as community, you know, with our lives on the line, we need to make sure that we don't, you know, that we are not placated, that we continue to figure out how to be at that table and be vocal, be verbal, be active. If they don't let us into, you know, those decision-making tables, we have to continue organizing, you know, within the community and make sure that those neighborhood networks, that those community ties are strong so that we can be sure that we can, you know, defend ourselves and do what we need to do in the face of that kind of threat. This step that I've taken to participate in a local election is a really important one that I really want to acknowledge and take responsibility for. It's something that has been you know, really scary at times, and it's also really really eye-opening in a lot of ways. You know, as connected to community as I've been, you know, this just kind of takes you. This kind of experience kind of takes you deeper into both sides, right? The community, you hear, you know, a little bit deeper perspective on some things, and also, you know, just the game of politics is it's enlightening to be inside of that. But I think it's important that people like me, and there are so many people like me that are, you know, just as passionate, just as committed to community and just as capable to participate in a local election. I think it's important that more people like us, do take that step and really literally work together to reclaim City Hall, to actually work for community and not for City Hall, for and city staff. We really need to take these bold steps to start to fill that gap between City Hall, community representatives, and the actual communities that are impacted by the decisions made at City Hall. And that it doesn't take, you know, it doesn't have to take a lot of money to do it. The way we're doing it is really, really low budget. It's a low budget, high stakes campaign. You know, we have, nothing to lose and everything to gain. And, all of it is a step, you know, towards, again, bridging that gap between our representatives and the communities that they should be accountable to.
How would someone go about reaching you if they want information about your campaign?
We're on Facebook at JOG4D3. We also have a website, jessicaoguerrero.com. And we have an email. It's jessicafordistrict3@gmail.com. And we have a phone number as well, 210-724-4811. Thank you. I'm glad you're doing this. This is cool.
Right, man. Don't you just love her, man? She's cool as fuck. Coming up next, we got Jess Herbst, the first transgender mayor of Texas from the town of New Hope.
I am the mayor of New Hope, Texas, which is just north and east of Dallas, and I am the first openly transgender mayor in the state of Texas. I'm married. I've been married for 36 years, and I have two daughters who are in their mid-20s.
So have you experienced any backlash as a result of fully coming out transgender?
Absolutely not. I have experienced quite the opposite. Everybody that I have encountered from The sheriff of Collin County, the rest of the people in my town, the people I work with, everyone has been just amazingly supportive. And people that you wouldn't think so. Just everybody just seems to take it in stride. And with my city council meetings, you never there's never a word about me being transgender or ever been brought up.
Well, so have there been any obstacles, have you experienced any grand obstacles in the transition itself?
No more than, you know, your regular physical transition issues, you know, finding the right size shoes and, you know, learning what clothes look best and fit. And but no, I mean, actually, it's been amazingly easy. Exactly the opposite of what I thought my entire life. It, you know, I always thought, oh, it would be so hard. It'd be so difficult and people would be, you know, so mean. But it's all been just a piece of cake, which surprises me as much as I think it does anyone else.
I guess it was more of a fear kind of built up in your mind that people wouldn't be as, I guess, accepting or as supportive.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that fear kind of exists in every transgender person I know, and I know quite a few. There's, you know, we are kind of, I don't know if it's just part of our culture or if it has just something to do with the simple fact that we're transgender, but there's a fear in all of us, and it takes a while to put it past you. I tell my friends all the time, it's like, look, it's not as hard, and most of them will still just look at me and say, oh, well, it was easy for you. I'm thinking, you know, it's going to be easy for everybody, but I know that there's that mechanism in most or really all transgender people's brain that says, no, I can't do this. People won't accept me. People will think there's something wrong with me. And I have not found that to be true. It's really kind of amazing.
Do you think that fear might be justified for some people? I mean, especially regarding the murder rate having gone up pretty substantially.
Well, there is a, you know, a great deal of violence imposed, particularly against transgender women of color. And, you know, sure, there's fear, and it's obviously justified, but, you know, there's murders anywhere. I mean, yes, there have been a lot of transgender women murdered, but I don't think anybody has taken those figures and said, well, okay, how many cisgender women have been murdered in those same neighborhoods and at what rates? I think right now there's a lot of media attention and media emphasis on transgender people, particularly in the last 2-3 years since Caitlyn Jenner came out and Laverne Cox and, you know, Transparent on TV. And then there's more people like me showing up all the time. So I think that I'm not saying there's not a problem with transgender women being attacked, but I think that I think we're looking at it harder than we used to. And it's good. We need to see it. But I've never seen anybody say, well, is it a higher rate than just the normal population? So, you know, that fear is there. Yeah, but I think it's just a normal fear that you should have as a human being. I mean, there's certain areas of town that are not good. There's certain activities you can participate in that, you know, are going to raise your chance of being hurt. And I really don't know that being transgender has a whole lot to do with it. I think that other people in those situations might also have been hurt just as easily. So I guess I'm not saying don't be afraid of being hurt. Just, you know, don't blame it on being transgender. Being transgender is just another part of who you are.
As a political figure, in the state of Texas, where do you stand on the recent passage of SB4?
Well, I think that SB4 is just absolutely ridiculous. It is something that I've talked to my congressman about. I've talked to my senator, my House of Representatives. I have not had an opportunity to speak at the hearings. I have with the SB6 and the 2899. But it's just an excuse of a way to oppress people. And the worst thing is that it's going to make a mockery of police departments, because now you have a rule that says your police officers can disobey their captains, and if they disobey their captains, they can actually fine or fire the captains or sheriffs. You know, it undermines the authority of the existing police departments, and so it's a poorly thought out bill. It's a kind of just a backlash bill aimed at making a few political points, and it really does absolutely nothing for the population. It doesn't solve any problems. It just causes more.
Do you ever experience conflict with trans-exclusionary radical feminists?
Yes, I have. I was testifying before the Senate House Committee on, the City Committee on State Affairs. I was opposed to the SB6 bill that was their bathroom bill. And I was one of the invited speakers on the against side. And we had a woman who was on the for side that really, got very disruptive, she turned around and looked at a group of transgender people that were in the room and called us all trans mafia. But fortunately that's been the only real, in my face kind of experience. I'm aware of them. I see them, online. I read their comments, but in public, that's really my only exposure. And it was enough. I can do without them.
Where do you stand on the use of excessive force and the call for more accountability by law enforcement?
Well, as a human being, as well as a political figure, excessive force is never necessary. It leads to a undermining of the political, of the social confidence in our law enforcement. You can almost always solve any situation without using a great deal of force, unless you have somebody that is, applying force to you. If you have a suspect that is actively attempting to attack a police officer, has a weapon, and even then there are ways that you can do this without killing people. And certainly shooting into, moving cars, which just recently happened here and killed a 15-year-old boy, innocent boy, all of that, it's not only, harmful to society, but it's harmful to the police officers themselves. In the long run, what happens is they become more fearful because the citizens become more fearful, and it just escalates until it's just, it's an out of control situation. So, I'm assuming that you're referring to, we've had a couple of bills where they're aimed at stopping, there's been a lot of police. I'm trying to get the correct words for this. The Obama administration initiated a program for police accountability. And now the Trump administration has reversed that. So say, no, you police departments do whatever you want. And I think that's just, it's gonna harm us in the long run. It's gonna harm us in the short run.
Do you have any words of advice or resources that our transgender sisters and brothers who might want to reach out to, organizations that are making a positive impact?
Sure. There's lots of organizations that are, doing wonderful things for transgender people. In general, the Human Rights Campaign is doing some really wonderful things. In the state of Texas, Equality Texas is doing quite a lot for us. There are your best resources are your local groups, and there are groups. In Dallas, there's a group called Transcendence. Virtually every city has some type of group, and if you reach out to them, what I found when I was, before I came out publicly and transitioned, as I was learning more about the transgender community and really learning about who I am, I found that the most helpful thing was just to find some other people who are transgender and spend some time with them. Get to know them. You'll get to know yourself. Facebook is a great place to meet people. There's meetup groups. The most important thing I can say is you're not alone. And if you feel like you're alone, find some people like you, find some other transgender people. We're everywhere. Get to know your fellow transgender people, and it will make life a whole lot easier for you.
What if someone lives in a small town?
Well, if you're in a small town, reach out in Facebook. You would be absolutely surprised. I live in a very small town, 673 people. And I was at I was in Dallas, and I was at a Christmas party, transgender Christmas party, and there were some people I had met. And I was talking to one of the girls, and we started talking about, I'm out in the country and small. And she was like, well, so am I. And it turned out she lived a half a mile away from me. So,
that's pretty cool.
It's gonna be, Yeah, it is. It's going to be a little harder to find someone, particularly in a small town, but just don't believe that they don't exist. They do exist. It's just a matter of getting the right connections. And it might be, you know, it might be through a Facebook post. It might be through a meetup group. It might be through somebody else, maybe just in, you know, an LGBT, group that you can join. GLAAD is a good, example. They have, you know, social get togethers all around in almost every town. So it, you know, you got to do a little looking. It took me a while. I'm 58 years old. I didn't really start exploring the feelings that I had in a serious way until I was about 50. And that was really what did it. I started reaching out. I started looking around on the internet until I found groups of people, that were transgender. And it was a scary thing, but I left the house. I went and I met them, and it was the best thing I ever did.
Awesome. I'd like to thank you for your time. I really appreciate it, you taking time out to talk to us.
Well, you're certainly welcome, and thanks for having me on.
Derek Jensen, writer of over 25 books, including Endgame, The Culture of Make-Believe, and The Myth of Human Supremacy, has for years been an advocate for indigenous peoples as well as a strong critic of domestication and rape culture. He joins us today to rap about direct action and self-care amidst a world of horrors. How do we reconcile technical ability to enhance some aspects of our lives, like global communication, for example, with the need to scale back its horrendously destructive effects on the Earth and its people? I mean, are there good technologies, or?
Well, in terms of global communication, I think that we need to recognize, and I'm following Jerry Mander on this, that even though you and I can have a nice chat here by telephone, and that I can call up, my niece in Houston and chat or talk to friends in faraway places. We need to recognize that those technologies are primarily used, and they're used much more efficiently for purposes that are destructive of the planet and destructive of human communities, and by which I mean, in this case, you know, telephones or something, telephones, the internet, all that are used much more effectively by the military and by the global corporations than they are for us. The current state of the globalized economy couldn't happen without, you know, computers and the internet the way they are. So I think, I'm going to back up a second, and, you know, a couple decades ago, I interviewed Theodore Roszak, who had written some really good stuff back in the 60s and 70s and 80s against high technology. And I interviewed him, and the interview was never published. It was a terrible interview because he was now all rah, rah, high tech. And I asked him, so what happened? And he said, well, I had open heart surgery and it saved my life. And so I recognized that that surgery was really miraculous. And so I became a big fan of high technology. And the problem is that a technology should not be judged by how it benefits you, but instead by how it affects society and how it affects the living planet. I mean, slavery, if I'm a slave owner, I mean, slavery is a great deal. You know, I've got lots of people working for me. I'm making money off that. It's from that perspective. So you can't judge whether an institution or a practice or a technology is beneficial simply by whether it benefits you. And a great example of this is I have Crohn's disease, and 2 days from now I will be getting my bi-monthly infusion of this nasty high-tech genetically modified medicine that is literally keeping me alive. It's kept me alive for the last 10-11 years. And I recognize that, that it's keeping me alive, but at the same time, I recognize that it is part of this larger destructive system, and you can't just abstract it to say, wow, this is really groovy, because last night, you know, the internet's groovy because last night I got to watch an 18-inning game between the New York Yankees and the Chicago Cubs. It's like, it's also used for incredibly destructive purposes.
It evolves within the class context, too, which I think it's ignored a lot. There's that Chomskyan ethic out there that technology is neutral.
I'm going to do the thing I love to do, which is to jump in and mention Lewis Mumford's Democratic and Authoritarian Technics. He says that no technology emerges in a vacuum. There is an interaction between a technology, between a specific tool, and the society. So a technology will not only emerge from a specific mindset, but it will also then lead to a specific mindset. And a great example of that would be refrigeration. For example, the Talua Indians here where I live did not invent refrigeration. It's not because they were too stupid. It's because there were so many salmon and meat stays fresher in the fridge, in the stream than it does in a refrigerator. So there's absolutely no reason for them to have invented this. It wouldn't have occurred to them. So the point I want to get to is that Mumford made the point that some techniques, that's what he called the combination of social and technological, that interface or that interplay. And some techniques are democratic and some are authoritarian. And a great example of an authoritarian technique would be anything associated with mining, because mining is such a miserable existence that it was one of the first forms of slavery. And the only way you can get people to go into mines is at the point of a gun, essentially, and or early on at the point of a spear, whatever. So if you have something that requires mining, then it's going to lead to an authoritarian mindset. And in addition, if it is something that you can't make in your backyard, that also will be authoritarian because other people can then control it. So a great example of this is that bows and arrows would be a democratic technique because I can make one. However, I'm not saying there's no talent involved in making it. I'm not saying there's no experience.
I'm sure there's a certain level of skill involved.
Absolutely. I'm not saying there's not. What I'm saying is that as long as I live in a forest, as I do, no one can prohibit me from grabbing a branch and somehow fashioning a bow and grabbing a smaller branch and making a small arrow and fashioning some bowstring for it somehow. And so that can't be controlled. But on the other hand, if I have a gun, without access to bullets and gunpowder, I just have a big club. You know, they can control my access to that. Here's a great example of this. I was getting interviewed a few years ago by a Marxist who, this just cracks me up. He was saying that he believes it's possible to have a society in which all exchanges are voluntary and in which there is no coercion whatsoever.
I'm interested in the specifics of this theory. That would be monumental.
Well, the specifics fall apart pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And he believed you could have an industrial society like this. I said, okay, great. So you have a city, right? He said, yeah, we have a city of 1 million people. Great. I said, how do you get around the city? He said, mass transit. I said, what do you make your buses out of? He said, metal. I said, okay, great. How do you get people to go in the mines? And I gave him a little spiel I just gave you. And he said, well, you just pay them a lot of money. I said, I don't really get it, but I'll accept that for now. But we do recognize that every single mine on the planet destroys, if it's near a waterway, it destroys water quality. We understand that, right? And he said, yes. I said, okay, great. So what about the people who live by the river? He said, you pay them to move. I said, what if they've been living there for 5,000 years and their ancestors there and they refuse to move? He said, well, you paid them lots. They said, their ancestors are living there. They're not going to move.
Money is the answer to every possible social problem.
Well, it's the first answer, and we'll find out what the second answer is in a moment. And so I said, they will not move. He said, well, in that case, we vote. And the 1 million people in the city vote to displace the 500 people living next to the river, and then you kick them off. And I said, ah, so what you've done is moved within 1 minute from purely voluntary exchanges to democratic empire, genocide, and land theft from the indigenous people, all so you can have a bus. And so that's what I mean when I say that technologies aren't neutral, because a bus requires mining, which requires this entire system of you have to get access to the mine, you have to make sure, and then you got to transport the stuff, which means you also have to have a police system to make sure nobody steals it along the way. So I firmly believe, and it seems clear to me, that the material conditions of society, then they almost dictate the social conditions of society, the material conditions.
Okay.
If you want to have a mine, you're going to have certain social governing structures in place to make it work. From my perspective, this is an intellectual problem that anarchism would need to, I think, more fully address, is that, you know, anarchists are fond of saying the state isn't necessary, and I completely agree that the state is not necessary for survival, it's not necessary for many, many things, but if you want to have, in this case, a buzz, you're going to have the large-scale bureaucratic organization, what Lewis Mumford called the machine. You're going to have that in order to facilitate this production. Industrial production especially requires a state of some sort, which, by the way, I want to be really clear, is not an argument in favor of the state. In my mind, that's an argument against industrial production.
Well, that's something that's always bothered me is with anarchism in particular, is that it never has in mind a post-revolutionary plan for how society is supposed to be governed, you know, and how the vacuum of power is going to be filled.
That's a hugely important point.
It's hugely important, and I think that's the reason why most, I mean, it's kind of fucked up to say it, but it seems like that's why most other revolutions that they support fail.
Oh, I don't know why that's fucked up at all. I think that's just true.
Well, the truth hurts.
The problem is that it doesn't really matter whether you are, you know, Bolsheviks or Makhnovists or capitalists. If you're going to have production, that means you have to funnel resources toward the producers. And that creates that class conflict right there, because those resources have to come from somewhere. There is no surplus. You're taking it from somebody. And somebody already lives there. And you're taking it from their land. And this is not just the anarchists who fall into this. 20-some years ago, I was at this sort of conference workshop thing. And one of the exercises we did is we all sit around in a room and... I mean, sit around in a circle, and the moderator had us close our eyes and say, and this is like 1997, we close our eyes, and he says, so imagine what it would be like living in a sustainable society 20 years from now. It's like, obviously, 20 years has come and gone, or 20 years has come, and it's not here, so that whole thing was bogus anyway. But anyway, so you're sitting there, and I said, I want you to smell the sustainable community. I want you to envision it, and I want you to just describe it. And everybody's sitting around all, you know, smiling and everything, and they start describing, and they describe, you know, bicycling to work and all this other stuff. And I was just squirming in my seat. I was so uncomfortable. When they got to me, I felt like a jerk, because everybody else is describing these beautiful bicycle paths and all this other stuff. And I'm like, okay, first off, where do we get the metal for the bicycles? You know, where does that come from? Somebody's got to be working in a mine. And second, if we're in our little community and we've just made a way to get sustained, to live sustainably, which is not going to include metal bikes, if we found a way to live sustainably and somebody else with power decides that they want our land because there's uranium underneath it or rare earths or oil, they're going to take it and they're going to kill us.
Right, right.
And the third thing that bugged me is, like, how did we get there? How did we stop the sociopaths who are running the show right now? It's like, I just read this a couple days ago, and this is no surprise, that the richest, I think, 80 people or something like that on the planet own the same amount as the 50% of the poorest. It's
wow.
Like, how do we stop them? But there was no acknowledgement of any of that stuff. I mean, so here's the question I always ask is, what do you want? And if you want a bus, and I don't think buses are unreasonable, they're fine things, but if you want a bus, you're going to have mines, which means you're going to have the whole system. You can't abstract them. You can't abstract this delightful little telephone over which we're having this delightful little conversation. You can't abstract that from the whole system.
Well, people are so completely divorced from or they're just completely ignorant of the fact that everything that we have here comes at the massive expense of someone probably like halfway around the globe. Because it's so removed from us, it's a lot easier to just pretend like it's not there, like it's not happening. But it totally is.
I can use my groovy computer and completely ignore the fact that it gave women cancer in Thailand, because I don't see them. And I can completely ignore the rare earth mining in Bautu, and I can completely ignore I don't have a cell phone, but if I did have a cell phone, I could completely ignore the effect on with the coltan and, you know, both gorillas and human beings in the Congo.
So what about groups like the EPA then? I mean, personally, I don't think that they're really doing, that they were really doing anything substantial to begin with, but people are really up in arms at the current administration's efforts to roll back their policy, cut their funding, and populate the organization with climate change deniers. I mean, were they doing any good really to begin with?
Well, there's the thing, is that I have friends like Thomas Lindsay who argues that a lot of environmental regulations are actually harmful because pollution, for example, should not be regulated. It should be completely prohibited. I don't disagree with that at all. I completely agree with him on that. Nonetheless, I would rather, I am sort of the anti-purist on a lot of this stuff, that I actually don't care. So long as it means that rivers are a little bit cleaner, then I'm okay with it. I mean, I have a friend who works for the EPA who does great work on trying to fix up some of the problem caused by industry. He works on like Superfund sites. And in this case, I see both of their perspectives, and I agree with both of their perspectives that on one hand, you know, my friend who is working on the Superfund sites is actually making things so they are cleaner than they were before. And on the other hand, Thomas Lindsay is very clear, and he's right, that the entire structure of regulation is set up to regulate, to permit. You know, the permitting process permits, as he says all the time, as opposed to outright. He always says, you know, slavery abolitionists did not try to regulate slavery. They tried to outlaw it. And there were big fights going on among anti-slavery people as to whether they should be, you know, slavery welfare people who would make it so the slaves had slightly better conditions, and those who wanted to, they thought that many of the others who wanted it to be abolished were unrealistic. And I have a certain amount of sympathy for both of those perspectives. And so my answers on that always end up being a bit mushy.
Well, there's a tremendous amount of gray area in between. But, you know, often what differentiates reformers from revolutionaries is the belief that the system can be amended and made to work. Do you think that we can use the means we currently have to reform technology's impact on our Earth and society, or do we need to destroy the system entirely?
Well, so here's the deal, is I think we need to destroy the system entirely. But in the meantime, I think we should be doing whatever amelioration that we can. That's the thing, is if we all wait for the great glorious revolution, there's not going to be anything left. But if all we do is reform work, then there's also not going to be anything left. So here's where I come in, is I believe that the EPA does some good work as long as we're honest about the larger picture. So that would be the analysis I would take, is, and yes, I do believe in doing timber sale appeals, because anything to keep this, you know, 5,000 acres standing. I completely believe in that. At the same time, I recognize that, as David Brower said, you know, all of our losses, all of our victories are temporary and our losses are permanent, which is why we need to bring down the whole system. So I'm a big believer in doing reform work at the same time that you are advocating for the destruction of the entire system.
But Derek, says little Timmy, I buy fair traded Whole Foods and I use Dr. Bronner's and I recycle. Am I helping?
Not particularly. I think that there are some circumstances where one certainly can vote with one's dollar, and that is a means of doing something, but that is one very small and frankly pretty, for the most part, useless tool we can use, or tactic we can use. I don't want to use tool because we were being very specific about our use of tools earlier. Oh, for God's sake, no. No, this is one of the things that got me started on this whole, I'm doing a book right now on it's called Bright Green Lies. I'm just finishing a chapter on wind energy and how it's a big, horrible con. And the reason I started that book is because about 10 years ago, I had to maybe no, about 6 or 7 years ago, I was doing columns for Orion, and Orion asked me to have this dialogue with this guy who is calls himself a bright green. Alex Stefan is his name, and he's just dreadful. He was arguing, for example, that 100% recycling is both possible and sustainable. So I started actually doing the research into this, because that's just nonsense.
It sounds pretty absurd.
Yeah, it's incredibly absurd. And recycling, even metals recycling, is one of the most toxic processes. Aluminum recycling, you know, everybody, aluminum, yay, recycle aluminum. First off, a lot of aluminum is used in paint. A lot of it's used in various other means that are besides cans. So you can't have 100% recycling. Second, even if you had 100% recycling, demand for aluminum is still going up. Third, the process of recycling aluminum is incredibly toxic in terms of both byproducts, and it's also incredibly energy intensive, as you were just saying. And this is true for that. It's true for other metals recycling, copper recycling. Copper is one of the easiest ones to recycle, and it's still incredibly energy intensive.
That's something that always really bothered me about the whole quote-unquote clean coal initiative. Like, just because you put the word clean at the front of the term doesn't, it's actually still highly toxic. Like, there's no such thing.
Well, this brings us right to Guy Debord, doesn't it? And the spectacle. I didn't have this language when I was younger, but even when I was, and you know, I wasn't very politically aware as a teenager, but one of the first things that was really striking me was that I kept using the phrase, the triumph of form over content, that simply because you say something, wind energy is great, simply because you say it often enough, people then believe it's true.
That's what Hitler theorized, was that the bigger the lie, the more people are willing to believe it.
Exactly, and okay, here's a great example. There are 27 big cities around the United States that are really trumpeting that they are transforming to 100% renewable energy by the year 2030, 2050, whatever, and all the bright greens make this big, oh my God, we're making such a difference. Let's just ignore the deeper level of whether it's you really want to have all these wind energy, all this stuff. Let's just ignore that, because it's even more fundamental. But they all say they're doing 100% renewable energy. This is completely untrue. What they're saying, even if you accept it on their own terms, but nobody ever says this, is they are transforming to 100% quote renewable end quote electricity, which is about 20% of total energy usage. And that sounds a lot more exciting to say, oh, we're going to 100% renewable energy, than to say we're going to 20% renewable energy. And then you add to this that the greatest growth in so-called renewable energy is biomass, which is either growing stuff to burn or cutting down forests to burn. There are 27 pulp mills in the southeastern United States that are operating 24 hours a day just to cut down forests, pulp them, make them into pellets, and then burn that for electricity. And this is what they're calling renewable. The actual percentage in Germany, you know, the big energy miracle that Naomi Klein and all them talk about, the big solar miracle. Solar provides, I think it's solar and wind together, provide about 2.5 to 3%, I believe it is, of Germany's energy. That's the miracle.
Well, do you think that the people who are promoting this idea are aware that it's bogus, or do you think they have ulterior motives, or, you know, what gives? Somebody has to be aware at that organization. I mean, somebody has to know.
That's the thing. Okay, I'm not a pedant. You know, I am kind of a pedant, but holding that aside. But so if I'm walking down the street and somebody comes up to me and starts talking about this, it's like, that's fine. But these are professionals who should know the difference. And the Sierra Club is touting this all over the country. This means there is not a single person in the Sierra Club who has raised this objection and they have responded to it. Either they did raise the objection and they were overruled, I don't know which is worse, or nobody raised the objection. There's not a single journalist in the country working for the New York Times, for any of them, who is saying, actually, no, it's not 100% of the energy. It's 20% of the energy. Because electricity is 20% of the energy, pretty much. That's reasonably standard. They cannot not know this. Another thing they'll do that just kills me is you'll see headlines saying, the other day, wind and solar provided 100% of the energy in Germany or whatever. And first off, it's 20%. We have to cut it down to 20% because of electricity. Second, what they don't tell you is this was for 1 hour on a sunny, windy day. And if you're going to have...
That's like optimum conditions.
Optimum conditions. Oh, by the way, also on a weekend when there's no industry running.
Ah.
And also a warm but not hot day, so there's no air conditioning and no heating. And they act as though this was... is a standard, and I've seen the distribution charts for how much energy is provided by wind and solar in Germany on an hour-by-hour basis across all the units. It follows a skewed bell curve such that there are lots of times it provides none, and then it provides the average is about 2.5% to 3%, what you'd figure, because that's what it is, and then it tails off, and the graph showing this, the point that they say that's so exciting that shows that this can now run an entire economy is like literally 5 standard deviations from the norm. It's 1 hour out of the year.
Yeah.
This is what bugs me. It's like you can promote whatever perspective you want, but had I done that sort of statistical sleight of hand when I was in college taking a class in statistics, I would have failed.
Well, it's straight up unethical.
Yeah, and this is the question always. Do they really understand? Did they write these books not even doing the basic? Or here's another great example, and this one I just learned yesterday. It pisses me off. I never knew much about David Suzuki, just that he's pretty famous. And he argues that the bird losses to wind energy are, quote, negligible, to use his word. And he cites the Royal Society for Bird Protection, the RSBP in the UK. And he quotes them, quote, negligible. What he doesn't do, I went and followed his sources because that's the sort of guy I am. I followed his sources. The article he's citing is an article by the RSBP arguing that they are not, in fact, in the pocket of the wind industry, even though they have, quote, partnered, end quote, with a windmill corporation. And they receive 60 pounds for every new customer who signs up with the wind energy company.
Mm.
And that's in the same article.
That's a dubious proposition.
You think?
Like that represents a complete conflict of interest for one thing, and possibly like criminal behavior.
And Suzuki cited the article, he cited the word negligible from the article where they're defending this and talking about the 60 pounds that they get per every new customer. But he didn't mention any of that. And that I find really unethical. I knock myself out in my writing, and we all make mistakes. We all just fuck up routinely. And like I was interviewing somebody, it was pretty funny. I was interviewing somebody about Buffalo, and it's just Stephanie C. And I just love her work. I love the Buffalo Field Campaign's work. I love everything about them. And I was interviewing her, and at one point, I said she was trying to say there were 60 million bison on the plains before they all got killed, and she accidentally said the bison had been on the plains for 60 million years. Which, of course, they were not there at the time of the dinosaurs. We all do that. I can't tell you how many times I've, like, that's one reason I don't like listening to my talks, is because if they do record it, I do listen to it, it's like, oh, I did not mean to say 200 million. I meant to say 20 million. You know, it's like we all screw up.
Yeah, I think a slip up is, you know, obviously kind of forgivable, you know, but to a degree, but you know, that's what you just described with David Suzuki sounds like borderline just unethical, you know, like intentionally lying.
Intentionally hiding stuff. So I really try to not do that. And I try to follow sources back. I think a lot of these people I don't know whether they are lying to themselves or simply lying to other people.
Well, I guess while we're on the topic of ethics, is it ethical to break the law in defense of nature? And can you clarify the issues surrounding this whole invention of, like, eco-terrorism? Like, who are the terrorists and what is their real goal?
Well, the real terrorists are those who are killing the planet, of course, and they have the full power of the state behind them. And you want to talk about some terror, that's the terror of if you try to protect the place using any means necessary, they will kill you. And this doesn't happen much in the United States. Here in the United States, the main thing we have to worry about is that our neighbors might not like us. Right now, most of us. I've always remembered something that John Stockwell, he was a CIA agent who
Have his
came
book.
Out against. Oh, yeah?
Yeah, In Search of Enemies.
Yeah. He was he was really important to my politicization. I was driving in a car somewhere in 88, 89, 87, somewhere, I don't know when, and for some random reason, they played a speech of his on some radio station somewhere, and in fact, I was just talking about him a couple days ago with my mom that we were watching a documentary about drones killing people all over the world, U.S. drones, and I said to my mom that John Stockwell says the best way to make somebody hate the United States is by killing their family members, and that line has stuck with me ever for 30 years now, almost. And anyway, another line he said was somebody was saying, well, if everything you say is true, why are you still alive? Why haven't they killed you? And he said, because they're winning. And that's really true, that for the most part, they're winning, they being the corporations, et cetera, are winning in the United States. So for the most part, they don't have to do a lot. But in non-industrialized nations at the frontiers, I just was reading the other day about forest defenders in Central and South America getting killed. And there was a park ranger in Dominican Republic or Haiti, I don't remember which, who just got killed. That's what happens when the other side does not have quite such a firm grasp on the reins of power. But here, they don't have to because we all buy into the system, which doesn't alter the fact that underneath it all, and we've seen the sorts of penalties meted out to Green Scare victims. But I think, in terms of your question, is it okay to break a law in order to do that greater good? I think, you know, Harriet Tubman was breaking the law on the Underground Railroad. Everybody who participated in the Underground Railroad was breaking the law. I've gotten in trouble because, with anarchists, because I once was giving a talk and I said, you know, I understand that laws are made primarily by and for the wealthy. And that's what they are. The powerful making rules that benefit the powerful. We all understand that. And I said, having said that, that doesn't mean I have a problem with laws or strictures against rape. And some anarchists freaked out because I was saying I don't have a problem with laws against rape.
Well, you know, I think a lot of times people tend to lump everything into like one big monolithic issue. And I think that kind of shows a very simple understanding. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of gray area there. And some laws are like, were you going to argue with a stop sign? There's some things that are just a matter of basic utility that would still have to be regulated in a post-revolutionary society.
Yep, I completely agree. If you're going to have car culture, which it seems like you and I would agree that we eventually would not want to have car culture, but if you're going to have car culture, stop signs are a good thing.
Right. And they prevent deaths.
Yeah, and I believe that you should not be able to drive 75 miles an hour well drunk through a school zone. If you're going to have car culture.
Right,
if you're
going
to have car culture, then obviously you don't have to worry about it.
Well, those are things that come, it's inevitable with domestication and civilization.
Yep. Okay, so back to your point. I don't think that law breaking by itself is in all cases a good thing. I think even if you're Nazi Germany, you still should not fuck a child.
right, okay. Yeah. There has to be a base to stand on somewhere.
But if there are reasons to violate laws, such as I think that the laws that the people who attempted to assassinate Hitler in World War II, I don't have a problem with that at all. And the people who smuggled Jews out, and the people who did sabotage against the Nazi regime, don't have a problem with any of that. I think that's in fact far from having a problem with it. I think those are heroes. And it's the same with laws here. That I think what's important is that the trees stay standing, and how they stay standing is really just a matter of strategy and tactics.
Would a primitivist society still have to deal with our current conception of identity politics? Because there's the struggle against racism, the struggle against patriarchy. There's like so many overlapping struggles. Would those still exist if we were to go back to a non-domesticated lifestyle?
I'm going to answer that with a kind of roundabout analysis. Peggy Reeve-Sanday talked about the markers of a high rape culture, and a lot of them are what you'd expect. If men are valorized and women are not valorized, she studied cross-culturally, and if men are valorized and women are considered less than, that's probably a high rape culture. If child rearing is devalued, that's probably a high rape culture. If it's militaristic, it's a high rape culture. If the primary creator deity is a male as opposed to a female or a couple, that's probably a high rape culture. All those are kind of what we'd expect. And there was one that I found really interesting, which is, if there is a history in the last 300 to 400 years of ecological dislocation, then there, that's probably a high-red culture. That's what she says, and now I'm extrapolating. There are two things I want to point out. One of them is, what that suggests to me is, when a patriarchal culture is stressed, especially, men often take it out on women. So we all see this. When the mill closes, rates of domestic violence go up. When there's a war, men beat on women, men rape women. And that's part of it. And then the other point I want to make is that it takes 300 to 400 years, this is the real point, for a culture to metabolize trauma and to calm down and for stories to change and for the culture to change. So if there was an EMP hit and destroyed all the electronics today, people would still be the patriarchal, racist people they are right now. That wouldn't change just because we have some circles and we hang out and we talk nice thoughts or whatever it is that we do. It would take 300 to 400 years, take 7, 8, 9 generations to transform. And so we can have a theoretical discussion about what it would be like in a theoretical culture, but those of us who oppose a lot of these horrors, I just finished writing a book on rape culture with a friend, and one of the points I made in it is that those of us who are working to stop rape will never see the promised land. We will not even get what Moses did, you know? We don't even get to see it, because it's the best case scenario is it's 7 or 8 generations away, which doesn't mean we don't do our work, by the way, just being clear.
Well, I notice that a lot of people, especially like in the activist community, well, they'll burn out really fast, or they'll become tired or like disillusioned with a war that seems to them kind of like unwinnable. So, I mean, is the struggle eternal, or how do we practice proper self-care? I mean, how do we keep our spirits up in the face of an overwhelming threat to not just us, but the planet as a whole?
Well, I think one thing we do is we get off our butts and do work, whatever the work is. And that helps a lot. And I don't remember who it was who said that action is the antidote to despair. And I actually don't mind despair either. Despair is a perfectly appropriate response to a desperate situation. I am standing, as we talk, I'm standing next to a pond. And earlier I saw a newt, which makes me very happy. And in this amount of time, 10 years ago, I would have probably seen 5 or 6 newts. But I'm still happy to see this one. And this pond, it breaks my heart, because 15 years ago, the frogs were so loud that you could not have a human conversation outside at night during this time of year. And now there are probably three frogs I heard last night. And I have been trying to save these frogs, getting in the pond to do things. And that's not important what I'm doing right now. But the point is that today's Monday. I got in the pond Saturday, and for the third time this year, I saw no Pacific tree frog egg sacs. I saw a bunch of red-legged frog egg sacs, which is very, very good, but I saw no Pacific tree frog egg sacs. I have not seen any non-spent egg sacs this year for Pacific tree frog egg sacs. And in previous years, at this time of year, I should have seen 100 egg sacs. And I cannot bear that. And anybody who is paying any attention at all is living in this horrible, a world of wounds, and it is incredibly painful. And what I do to survive that is, A, use that to fuel my work, and B, cry. I cry a lot, and I talk to friends who also cry a lot and who care as deeply and who are doing everything they can too. And
that reminds me actually of a very similar analog that I heard, I think, from Michael Parenti, where he was saying that apathy is a psychological defense against powerlessness.
That makes perfect sense. I love that line. Thank you.
Well, you know, gee whiz, Derek, you make some good points, but I'm overwhelmed, you know, not just by information, but just by life. What can I do to make a positive impact, and how do I educate myself?
Well, when people say, what can I do, I always give them the same answer, which is that I don't know who you are, so I can't tell you what to do, but I can ask you 3 questions, or I can make 3 suggestions. The first is, what do you love? Find what you love and defend it. Whatever you love, it's under assault, whether that love is for frogs or newts or a piece of ground or open discourse or women. You know, I got a friend, Charlotte Watson, who used to run the Battle Women's Program for the state of New York, and she's wonderful. She asks every man she sees, what will it take for men to stop beating on women? She's relentless. You know, if you get in a taxi with her, she'll say, can you take it to Central Park? And by the way, what's it going to take for men to stop beating on women? Do not ever get on a subway with this woman. She's wonderful. And the point is, I would never suggest her, oh, you got to work on salmon issues. I know this one woman who is just in love with prairie dogs, and she works really, really hard to protect them. I know somebody else who's in love with beavers, and she works really hard to protect them. And I would not suggest that the woman stop working on prairie dogs or beavers and start working on Port Orford cedar. You know, that's the wonderful thing about everything being so messed up is no matter where you look, there's great work to be done. So find what you love and then work to defend it. Second thing is find out what your gifts are and then ask how you can use them in the service of the land and or in service of justice, whatever you want. That so many people have said to me over the years, gosh, Derek, you've written all these books. Why don't you stop and be an organizer? The thing is, I hate organizing, and I'm not an organizer. I'm a writer, and I know people who, for fun, will go and leaflet outside Walmart, and it's like, oh my God, you actually have to talk to people? It's like, I can't. My happiest days are when I spend all day by myself writing, and that.
Well, I think everybody can contribute, you know.
Yeah, exactly. But, and like a great example, there's this guy, Norris, who is a computer whiz. He is so, he's one of the most important members of any organization he's in, because everybody's always going, Norris, my computer stopped working. Norris, we can't make the conference call work. And, you know, without a Norris, we're all lost. Or accountants, you know, there are so many. We don't need to get into the whole 501c3 thing in general, but a lot of these places need accountants to help them out with paperwork and to help them out with their accounting. I mean, here's the question that Carolyn Raffensperger asks. What are the largest, most pressing problems that you can help to solve using the gifts that are unique to you and all the universe? And one of the wonderful things about acting in your gifts is you don't have to do anything special. You just have to be yourself, you know? I mean, honestly, I realized early on that, you know, one of the reasons I write the stuff I do is because my mom raised me right. And what I mean by that is that if I see a problem, instead of just complaining about it, I go ahead and complain about it, but I also try to fix it. And I saw that there was a hole in discourse. And the hole in discourse was that there were, like, angry American Indian writers, and there were angry feminist writers, and there were angry African American writers. But most of the environmental writers were all peace, love, groovy. And I'm like, fuck that. I'm pissed off at what's going on. And there's a wonderful thing about just being yourself, which is that you don't have to do backflips. I realize this is the most important realization I ever had about writing, is I don't have to do anything fancy and step outside myself. I just have to be myself and then write my stuff. And so somebody who's really good, like if I were trying to do the computer stuff that Norris is, it's like I would, what's the term? Rage quit. I would rage quit immediately. This would kill me. But he can do it. And then the third thing is, these are all ways to avoid burnout and everything else. This is the third question. First question, what do you love? Second question, what are your gifts? Third question, what do you get off on doing? I like the phrase get off on doing as opposed to what do you love doing, because what do you love doing is like, oh, walks on the beach and something personal then. But instead, I was hanging with this guy one time. We were working to protect some land, and he's a wetland specialist. And one of the things he would do is dig in the soil, rub the soil between his fingertips, and then compare that to a color on a chart, and I would tell him if it's wetlands, which means it has a greater level of protection. So as he's doing this, I looked at him. I said, do you get off on doing this? He said, oh, yeah, this is my second favorite thing to do in the world after playing with my dogs. And I started laughing and said, this is great because, honestly, I would hate doing this. And on the other hand, I completely get off on trying to figure out the relationship between perceived entitlement, exploitation, and atrocity. You know, I've condemned myself to a life of homework. And that's fine. He would hate that. I would hate what he's doing. I was working with this attorney one time, and she gave a real discount to us on trying to protect this land because I was doing a lot of the writing for her. She said, if you do a lot of the writing, I'll give you a discount. I said, great. I start doing this writing, this this legal writing. I hate it. Oh my God, it's horrible. And I said to her, do you get off on writing this crap? She's like, oh yeah, I love writing this crap. Well, I love writing this stuff, she said. And so that's the thing is, if you're not going to get burned out if you're doing what you get off on doing. I used to, when I was in college, I worked at NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And some of my bosses would call in sick and then they would show up 2 hours later because they couldn't bear to miss the experiment. I was like, man, that's how I want to be. And so if you find something that you love doing so much that you would do it even if you're feeling kind of sickly, then you're not going to get burned out. So what I would suggest is that people ask themselves those three questions and then get off their butts and do something and try stuff. And if you try something and it doesn't work and you're not very good at it, you don't like it, then don't do it and do something else instead. But everybody can get off their butt and do something for 1 hour a week, 2 hours a week. That's where it starts.
Intellectual, lovable, hateable, my style is unshakable, unbreakable will, infallible skill, chill but not cold, reflection unfold, unclean, uncontrolled. My hands are old, but my body is young, I work miracles with my tongue, and the breath in my lungs, the heroes unsung are the ones I admire, I will never tire, or be defeated by the way I've been treated, impeded and cheated, I will never give up until my work is completed, mystical, magical, theatrical, animal, casual, practical, rational, radical, tactical, knowledge of guns and ammo, as well as spiritual matters intangible. I am an unflappable dude who likes to seclude into solitude. People think I'm rude and cruel because I really don't want to listen to melodrama. I don't give a damn about the opinions or moral positions or superstitions. A million visions of cognitive bias spreading like a virus in defiance of reason. It's very displeasing. People always deceiving themselves.
I ain't lying. You best not be saying. Or you better believe that you will be paying. I got the money and I got the gun, son. You better come correct when you come to number one. I got the balls and I got the blaster. You better come correct cause I'm coming for that ass. I'm fucking illin', cold beer and boogie chillin'. My life is tricky, I'm puffin' on the sticky icky. I'm puffin' smoke on a daily basis. Chronic oasis, maintain a homeostasis. Sonic, stereophonic, pleasure for the dome. Gonna leave you on your ass with a mind that is blown. Your fucking jaw. You got nerve, but you got no fucking clout. I rip your motherfucking
ludicrous system out. I gripped the shoddy with psilocybin in my body. I can't be saved when my pupils are dilated. Trade a balance for bullets for you who with donuts. I go nuts, taking names of fucking butts. I never fucking slip with my kung fu grip. Lyrically, I will rip off your nips with my lips.
I want to thank all of our guests who took time out here to be here with us, and to all the people who supported us for this episode. This episode has been brought to you by Drugs, distributed to your poor communities of color with the help of your Uncle Sham since ever. This is J-Dub, reminding you to educate, organize, and agitate until your voices are heard. And also that the Pope is a pedophile. Peace! Seriously though, the Pope fucks kids.